It is, thank you, Lauren, November 18th, 2021, and I'll call this meeting to order and turn it right over to Greg Geist.
All right, good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. I just have a few quick updates. Lauren, I thought there was a slide for, at least one slide for this.
Problem at all. Yesterday, I connected with the construction.
Not sure what that was. All right, so I'm going to start. Hopefully, you've all heard about this already. This is the Water Heroes Award that Wes received at the annual Water Environment Federation conference in Boise, one of only four agencies across the country. I was sitting next to, as we, in the what they call the green room, which felt very special to me. I've never been in a green room before, but basically where they staged us behind the stage. I asked the guy sitting next to me, who also got a Water Heroes Award, what he did or what they did. And he literally saved a person's life that had fallen in one of a homeless person that had fallen in one of their clarifiers. So he truly was a hero. But our award was for our performance during the ice storm. So, again, hopefully you all heard about that. And we got some good press, and I'm very, very proud of all of the people in operations and all the people that support operations that allowed us to perform so well and receive the award. So that's that. Also wanted to mention, we just signed a check or deposited a check to ODOT for our I-205 bridge crossing, which will bring an additional sewer line from West Lynn over the what will be the new Abernathy I-205 bridge. That project is about $9.2 million. And the way that the finance is structured and the federal requirements go, we needed to deposit that money in an account that ODOT can tap in advance of the project. So that was $9.2 million. That project is proceeding rapidly. They're going out with an RFP in December and expect bids in March. So the obvious question is, you know, our engineering estimates are $9.2 million, and that's what ODOT agreed to. So what if it's higher? Well, I don't exactly know what is going to happen if it's significantly higher. The estimate was made in September. By HDR, which is, you know, amongst the best engineering and design firms in the world. And we'll see. And so the bids will come in March. So we will know for certain what the costs are going to be, barring, extenuating circumstances in March. So the ODOT bridge crossing is proceeding. The other thing I wanted to mention is in 2022, so shortly, we are going to be developing, well, we're developing now, new onboarding procedures and processes and materials for West Advisory Committee members. So we want to make sure that when folks come on board, we give them everything they need to know, at least initially, to understand, you know, who we are, what we do, how things work, why we matter, that kind of thing. So expect that early in 2022. Also wanted to mention, and hopefully you may have received an email about December 2nd webinar for our Three Creeks project. And that's gonna be a webinar where we get public input on the goals of the project, preliminary designs, maps, or conceptual designs and concepts. So we are kind of in the early stages and kicking off that project and have some ideas and want to get people's input. So I think we'll make sure that we get a link sent out to all you folks if you haven't already received it, but that's going to be happening on December 2nd. And last thing is the North Clackamas Chamber of Commerce. And again, hopefully you've heard about this because I've tried to shout it to the world. The North Clackamas Chamber of Commerce has a program called Women in Leadership and Management. And they give annual awards to folks in that region. And we had the pleasure of having two folks with Wes receive those awards. One was Lynn Chicoine, who received the Public Service Woman of the Year Award, and Shelley Perini, who also received an award of Lifetime Achievement. which is remarkable considering she's so young. But anyway, well done to both of you. Last thing I wanted to mention, we sent out a doodle poll. We are looking at schedules for 2022. So please, if you haven't seen that or haven't received it, let me know and we'll get that to you. But we're trying to make sure that we get calendar certainty through 2022. So that's all of my opening remarks. I'll hand it over.
Lauren, I don't see an approval of the meeting minutes from the last meeting on here. Do we need to do that?
Yes, we do.
We are posting the audio. So within a day.
That's right. Okay, that's right, because we don't have to do that now. Okay, I knew that. I knew there was a reason.
Actually, does everybody know that, though? It slipped my mind that we had shifted from to yeah. So maybe, Lauren, you can explain what we're doing now.
So we record the meetings and we take the audio from that, and within a couple of business days of the meeting happening, we post the audio now to our website where all of the materials can be found. So typically where we would post the meeting summaries, once they're approved, they go out to the website and it now says audio instead of meeting summary. And so folks can go back there if they've missed a meeting or want to recap on what happened. And it's a lot quicker. So it's a much better process.
More efficient. I love it.
Yes.
Okay, good. All right. Then we will move on to the next presentation from Chris Story and Aaron on the financial policies.
Sorry, Chris, to jump in, but I meant to mention, we have a couple of pretty meaty topics tonight, and then I've got 15 minutes at the end to talk kind of general Clean Water Act, why we do what we do. I'm fully prepared to not give my part of that presentation. So if some of these go long and people start looking at the agenda and think we're behind, there's a pretty good likelihood that I'll just forego my 15 minutes at the end and we'll have a little bit of extra time. So.
Excellent. And with that, I understand my microphone is bad, so I truly am just going to turn my video off and try to get as close to the monitor as I can. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. So I'm going to offer a bit of an introduction, but the meat of this presentation is going to be done by Erin Blue. So I hope you will enjoy her presentation. I know I will. So next slide. Really what we're going to go through a couple different policies, but the big picture is we want to bring financial policies to you. We're going to build those into the budget planning process, and we wanted to have enough lead time to make sure that you had the opportunity to think about them before we started integrating them in a proposed budget that you will see next spring. So we have a couple on the docket today. There's going to be some more in January next year, and it's more making sure that you are giving us the direction we need to effectively build out a policy for you. And with that, I'm pretty much just going to go quickly and turn it over to Aaron, who will give you an overview of what we've been going through from a process standpoint. Next slide.
Great. So we wanted to just start off by providing a little bit of context for the objectives that we attempted with these proposed financial policies and an overview of what financial policies are intended to accomplish. Really, why are financial policies important? They're a key component in building any organization's financial resilience and viability, and they also help guide and direct financial management decisions. So they establish the structure for our operational and strategic decision-making in both our annual budgeting process and long-range financial planning. They set a baseline of stewardship over our resources, minimize our financial risk, and support bond ratings that lower the cost of borrowing, which in turn help West deliver services at the lowest cost to ratepayers. Formally adopted financial policies are considered an essential part of public financial management by the Government Finance Officers Association, American Water Works Association, North American Clean Water Agencies, EPA, and others. Next slide, please. Our objective in creating financial policies or updating, as the case is with these, is to comply with and complement statutory requirements around budgeting, debt issuance, procurement, as well as the requirements around bond indentures. Effective policies also go a step further than just restating requirements by articulating how WES will operate within our established guidelines to accomplish long-term strategic objectives. One key objective in drafting financial policies is to balance the level of control with flexibility. And as you can see by the chart on the slide there, there's a bit of a trade-off. As you'll see in the coming slides, certain policies may emphasize one attribute over the other. As an example, the draft policy that we're proposing for operating reserves, one of the objectives of that is to mitigate risk. And so that policy is structured to allow enough flexibility for us to address the complexities of utility operations and for management to respond nimbly to unforeseen events. Budgeting policies are another example of a policy that really emphasizes flexibility because of the need for stakeholder involvement, whereas debt policies typically emphasize more control to ensure compliance with bond covenants. Financial policies should be regularly reviewed and updated, and best practices specify at least every 3 to 5 years that an organization go through a review and update process. And that's to reflect changes in both strategic priorities as well as evolving statutory or regulatory requirements. They can be adopted at highly detailed levels, but key policies are really focused on the essential areas shown on that slide around reserves, debt management, financial planning, and revenues and expenditures. Next slide, please. So WES's current policies adhere to the county's general policies as applicable to enterprise funds or ratepayer funds. A two-page summary of our financial policies is provided in the annual budget document for those that are interested. So some of you have probably seen it and are a bit familiar with our existing policies. And you could observe by looking at those that it's a good, fairly broad set of policies for financial management. It isn't super detailed. And about a year ago, the county started their own periodic review and update of existing policies, some of which hadn't been updated since 2004 or even earlier in some cases. And their update is providing WES with an ideal opportunity to establish specific policies that complement the county's updates, as well as incorporate utility best management practices and enhance our transparency with stakeholders. So we're about to kick off pre-planning for the next fiscal year budget next month. And this is also a perfect time to be able to reflect any updated policies in the next iteration of our budget and financial planning and rate forecast process. We're starting with operating reserves, miscellaneous fees, and debt to mirror the county's updates. Next slide, please. So operating reserves is really considered to be an essential policy. And it's particularly important for an organization like WES, which is ratepayer funded and can't rely on any general fund revenue because we're financially independent and we provide essential services. So the operating policy would help us to mitigate risk and support continuity of operations in response to emergencies, such as we've seen in the last year with the ice storm and wildfires. Reserves are also a key factor in rating agencies' assignment of bond ratings. In this most recent debt issuance in February of this calendar year, S&P cited our extremely strong liquidity as one of the factors in giving WES the highest bond rating, a AAA. And those, as mentioned earlier, those high bond ratings in turn lower the cost of borrowing, which is reflected in lower rates to our ratepayers. And finally, reserves can also be used as a tool to ensure that we have stable, predictable rate increases, particularly if our revenues are subject to some degree of variability. And while most of our revenues are a fixed rate basis, we do have some variability in system development charges and commercial revenues. And those revenues can fluctuate in response to lower development activity and economic downturns, such as we've seen in the past year, that impact commercial businesses. We're also subject to a bit of revenue, at least collection, in terms of increased delinquencies on residential accounts, also something we've seen a little bit of in the last fiscal year. So operating reserves help us to mitigate the impacts of those factors. We don't currently have a formal policy for operating reserves, but to some degree, we're covered by the contingency policy and the county's existing policies. And that practice there is the current policy is just to specify that we'll budget a contingency. It doesn't specify a targeted amount, and that we'll manage our funds with the objective of our ending fund balance exceeding the original contingency. So essentially that we won't really spend that contingency unless absolutely needed. Our practice has been to, on the operations side, to budget about a 60 days contingency in the sanitary sewer operating and surface water funds, which is not currently in sync with our long-range financial planning, which assumes a $3 million reserve in the sanitary sewer side. Oh, William.
Excuse me, and I didn't know if you were going to be able to take questions during the presentation, but you know, I'm always bubbling with curiosity. The second part of this current policy, there's mm-hmm. 4 points there. The first two are in quotations. The last two are not. It doesn't give me the source of what that quotation is from.
Sure. Great point. The quotations are from the two-page summary that we have included on the annual budget document. There's a separate section in the About the Department section to cover financial policy. So we've kind of condensed what that says to illustrate what the current policy is.
I'm familiar with that document, and I appreciate you referencing it. It's just that there's nothing on this slide that told me exactly where that was coming from.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great point. And I think we could include a footnote in the future. But just to provide some context for the other slides, anytime you see quotes, we're referring to that same two-page statement of policies in the budget document.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And Aaron, if I can chime in, there is a typo on this. It says 30 days and not 60. So,
yes. Yeah, thank you. So the our long-range financial planning on the sanitary sewer side is $3 million. And so it's not in sync with the 60 days operating contingency we have in the budgeting side, which for the sanitary sewer side is approximately $4 million this year. And for surface water, it's about $1 million. Our long-range planning for surface water is currently assuming a $1.5 million reserve for long-range plan. So that's not in sync either. So one of our goals with the proposed policy is to synchronize the reserves used for both short-term and long-term financial planning.
Greg, I thought that was our current policy, and our proposed policy was going to 60 days.
You're correct. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, next slide, please. We'll see the proposed policy on this next slide. So we have some clear opportunities for improvement here. And any reserve policy needs to essentially answer three questions. How much, what are the conditions for use, and what types of reserves? So our how much, our reserve target is 60 days proposed. That's in sync with the county's updated policy for enterprise funds. It's also in sync with what we've been budgeting on the operational side. In determining the 60-day target, we not only considered the county's updated policy, but we also looked at WES's financial operations, billing frequency, our rate structure, the makeup of our customer base, and our desire to have availability of resources for other needs, such as capital planning. We also considered best practices or recommendations from organizations like Water Environment Federation and the Government Finance Officers Association, which recommend between 1 and 3 months or 30 and 90 days of operating costs or operating expenses. So we are proposing a 60 days contingency. And next slide, please.
William has a question.
William has another question.
Yeah, this particular slide is the one that I spent most time thinking about, and it was brilliant. I even shared it with some other people. But the biggest concern that I have, I only had two, and I apologize. I don't like to blindside people, but we only had a couple of days to look at this big document. But the issue, this first issue is the 60 days, the definition of 60 days. And I'm not talking about a definition of 60 24-hour periods. I'm talking about are our operating expenses constant throughout the year? Do we spend the same dollar amount every year, or is it seasonal? And if it's seasonal, which 60 days are we talking about? The last 60 days, the expected next 60 days, the same 60-day period from the previous year? to me, I just found this document lacking in specificity as to which 60 days we're talking about. And I don't know if that's clear or not, but it was a big issue for me.
Yeah, I appreciate that feedback. So the 60 days would be set based on our annual budgeted operating expenses. So it isn't identifying a specific 60 days within the year. It's just looking at the entire year and saying if costs were consistent over the entire fiscal year, we would have 60 days budgeted as a contingency or reserve. And about half of Wes's operating budget is labor. And so labor costs are very steady over the course of the year. There's some variability in some of our other costs. We see higher chemical costs and disposal costs for biosolids at certain times of the year. I don't know, Greg or Chris, if they want to jump in and talk about that.
Well, that's what I'm getting to, because in addition to the labor, this first paragraph talks about long range plan as well as not just labor. And I guess what I was getting at is, are all 60 days equal? No, I don't think so. That there's some seasonality or some different adjustments. And I think it would be good for us to define, are you just taking the year and dividing 360 days?
Right. Yeah, you're absolutely right, William. And what we're doing is, since the budget is a planning document looking forward, we're assuming 1/6 of the year should be available for emergency expenditures. Over time, we adjust that per year. So when we do financial planning, we adjust what that 60-day is based on the annual adjustments, but we don't target any particular 60 days within the year.
I want to make sure we're not short. And the fact that if we are going into a more expensive time period, will we have enough reserves if we need them?
Yeah, that's a great point. And we can definitely look at 60 days, what 60 days of reserves would mean on a rolling basis throughout the fiscal year, and do an analysis of variability just to see maybe what the high low would need to be. But that's great input. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And William, I only have a sense of this. I'm sure Aaron can really break it down by looking at the actual expenditures. But like she said, you know, we kind of have that baseline cost of people. And so that's very flat throughout the year. And then, you know, chemicals and electricity are two other major expenses, and those accumulate throughout the year. We don't buy all of our chemicals or all of our electricity during one quarter or another. So I think it's going to look fairly flat, but it's a good question and we'll look into it.
Thank you.
All right, next slide, please. A second question a reserve policy has to answer is what type of reserves. Wes's current policy really only looks at using a contingency, and our proposed policy is proposing to allow flexibility for meeting our 60-day target through a combination of budgeted contingency and or a designated operating reserve line item. And really the difference between these two would be a matter of timing and intent and flexibility. A budgeted contingency is determined annually with the budget cycle. It's appropriated at the budget level, and then it's meant to be available for emergency or unforeseen events that happen within that calendar year. Whereas a designated operating reserve line item is really something that's intentionally built up over time. And if we were going to use it, we would have an idea that it needed to be used when we were doing long-range planning and forecasting, as we would see in the future that there is a spike in operating expenses or potentially a decrease in revenue that would necessitate tapping into that reserve. So we are proposing to meet that target with a combination, and would determine that combination and how we would potentially build up the designated operating reserve line item in conjunction with long-range planning work. The proposed,
need to know, do we have plans for what we're going to do with unused contingency funds?
Yes, that's a great question. We do have in the proposed policy a designation for excess reserves, and we would treat those consistently with how our practice has been, which is to the extent that there are excess reserves, they would be used as a resource for capital expenditures. So anything not needed here would be diverted to capital.
They wouldn't roll over to next year.
If it was a designated operating reserve line item, it would. That's a good point. Budgeted contingency expires each year, but an operating reserve line item would be built up over time.
Okay. To me, a contingency is, you know, you've got this extra money that you can use if you need it. But if you don't need it, it seems a little strange to me to be collecting ratepayers' monies for something that we didn't have an emergency.
Right. And yeah, and the designated reserve line item would be more of a planning tool that we would have on hand if we were to ensure that we had stable, predictable rate increases in response to perhaps a decrease in revenue from an economic downturn. So it's something that would help us to propose a lower rate increase than might be needed to meet a future year operational needs. If something happens in the future that we know about, the contingency would be, we don't know about it, but we're planning just in case to mitigate risk.
I noticed the last line on that gives us considerable wiggle room on that.
Yes.
With no definition of what poor economic conditions are.
That's good feedback. We can certainly come up with some.
Yeah, certainly the policy doesn't attempt to define that, William. It's more aimed at making sure we have some degree of tools available. And then we would be coming to the advisory committee and having that discussion with the group about what that might mean regarding planned rate increases and funding of our capital projects and timelines, et cetera. There would be a sort of a mix of variables that would get into it. Really what we're trying to do here is establish, you might say, the baseline. So we know from a planning perspective what is expected of us from a financial planning standpoint, and then ensuring that we would have that available to support those contingency issues if they do arise. If they don't arise, what our model does from a long-term financial planning standpoint is if the money is not used, we push it over to fund capital projects such that we're basically decreasing the amount we have to raise rates in the future to pay for capital projects. So we're hopefully it's a wash as far as the ratepayers are concerned.
Okay, I'm just thinking of the cost of money is that future money is going to be more valuable than what it is now. We can talk about this later.
Yeah, I think maybe another good point to make is that if we were going to use part of our reserve line item, we would be proposing the use during the budget process, and there would be an opportunity for advisory committee and budget committee input, because it would be included in the budget. We would say we're drawing down $1 million or however much from the reserve line item to ensure that we can get by this year with a rate increase of only this much. Our proposed policy is also adding an option of setting aside funds in a specific rate stabilization reserve account, which is specified as an allowable account in Wes's bond master declaration. And that would be based on anticipated net revenue variability over a 5-year planning horizon. We aren't proposing to fund that right now. We're just wanting to have the option. If we did want to use it, we would come back to the advisory committee and budget committee for input and support. The target for that would be different. It wouldn't be part of that 60 days. We would instead set it based on 10% of our senior lien obligations or the bond debt service for the fiscal year. And that would help us to, again, ensure stable, reasonable rate increases and also ensure that we meet coverage requirements if we're looking at variabilities in revenue. And then finally, conditions for use. We're really just looking for use in consideration of unanticipated or unforeseen needs in the case of a contingency or potentially flattening rate increases if we're looking at poor economic conditions. One consideration for the operating reserve that we don't have up on the slide here is how we're proposing to fund that reserve, and that's through surplus revenues. So we aren't anticipating that there's going to be any rate impact in the short term. And to the extent that there would be a rate impact in the long term, it would be minimal and in the form of needing to issue debt slightly sooner than we would if we weren't setting aside this money for operating reserves. But we anticipate being able to cover the annual increases to keep the reserve proportionate to any changes in our operating costs with surplus revenues from the prior fiscal year. So we aren't anticipating an impact to rates there, only in terms of the timing of when we need to go out for debt. All right. So this is the last slide on operating reserves. Any other questions on those? All right. Next slide, please. Our second policy is a pretty straightforward policy on fee recovery. And when we're talking about miscellaneous fees, we're not talking about sanitary sewer or surface water user charges or system development charges. This would only apply to the small portion of WES's annual revenue that is derived from charges such as lien search fees or review fees. And currently, that makes up about 2.1% of our annual revenue, or about $1.2 million. So this is a very small portion. But in keeping in line with our goals and objectives for stable, predictable rate increases for user charges, we also wanted to articulate that that's our goal for fees. So the proposed policy is restating the updated county policy we will attempt to fully recover costs. But it also specifies a couple of objectives that are unique to WES as a utility. And that's that we'll look at cost recovery on a multi-year programmatic basis rather than a fee-by-fee basis, because we have fees where we have relatively fixed costs year-to-year, but the revenue is variable in relation to development activity or other activity. And so we want to ensure that the rates are stable and reasonable. And it also considers, as an add-on to the county's policy, a possible phased approach where we would, if we didn't notice that we needed to adjust a fee based on cost recovery, we would do it over multiple years to reduce the impact. And then lastly, the county policy does allow for potential inflationary adjustments, which would also be keeping in line with WES's policy for sanitary sewer and surface water rates. Any questions here? All right, cool. I'll hand it over to Chris. Thank you.
So our last policy, next slide, please, is relating to debt. And the debt policy, as I'm sure you saw from the packet, is voluminous, detailed, and specific to WES. This is actually somewhat unusual. WES is the only area of the county that has its own separate debt policy. Everyone else is underneath the county's specific debt policy. But because WES is so active in capital construction, we have our own policy. The amount of debt that WES has outstanding is actually about the same as the rest of the county combined. We are just a volume expender from a capital standpoint. So what we've been doing is running through several sort of iterations of best practices around this, and we wanted to make sure that we brought forward to you those findings. This is pretty much a restrictive approach to what we're trying to do, in that we are trying to be conservative, effective, and transparent with the issuance of debt. We are focused a lot on compliance, of course, because there are securities regulations for the issuance of the debt, and omission of information can be a crime. So it's an area that we take seriously. And each member of the board signs off on it. But there's a sort of inherent policy behind it. And I think I'll just jump to the next slide, and that will help us sort of narrow in on the key things. We are looking to effectuate a couple different policies. The first is the efficient and cost-effective funding of the WES infrastructure. We have talked a lot in this committee over the last several years over how we finance and build items. A lot of that is based on the fact that we have some reserves, but we actually went out, and you'll recall you approved us borrowing $40 million earlier this year, and we were able to do so at a extremely effective interest rate of 0.84%. So we locked that in anticipation of the market interest rates going up. I don't want to say that we were prescient, but I'm feeling very comfortable with that decision now, looking at what the market has been doing recently. So we are very confident that we were, and given the volume, we probably save ratepayers between $5 and $8 million by pulling the trigger now rather than waiting until later. So that's part of the debt policy, is knowing when to borrow, knowing what to borrow for, doing so in a way that allows us to gradually adjust rates to avoid the rate shock. You, as the advisory committee, gave us a direction, a band, that you wanted to keep rates within so there were no big jumps. And we try to adhere to that as while implementing our infrastructure plans. And one of the big issues that I wanted to flag for you as part of the debt process is something that Vice Chair DiLoreto flagged, which is borrowing the money to pay for a project ensures that future ratepayers help pay for the infrastructure that benefits them. In the sewer business, we have to pre-construct our infrastructure before people can use it. There's no such thing as connect and then we build what we need for them. Because if we try to do that, we'll have violations of the Clean Water Act. Debt becomes a tool not only of effective financing and rate management, but also of system participation. So our strategy has been to use the defining policy of rate path to then level out when we would borrow, what we would use to construct the facilities. So I wanted to flag that for you. You may be wondering what we do, and I'll emphasize again, Wes could do general obligation bonds, which are a separate property tax, although Wes does not levy a property tax. It is exclusively rate supported, but with a vote that could happen, but we have not done that and we don't plan on doing that. We use revenue bonds or obligations, and we use the sales via competitive auction, which is to say we don't do a direct placement with an underwriter. We open it up to the market. The market bids for the right to turn around and sell our bonds to their customers. And we use that money within 3 years. That's sort of the key heart of a 16-page policy document. So I just wanted to condense it for you. Yeah. Next slide, please. From a process standpoint, this is for all of them. It's a lot to digest. As William noted, you got it a few days beforehand. You may be busy and you didn't have time to read it as thoroughly as some others. So what we wanted to do is present the information to you today, ask you to think about it, send us questions, comments, observations, and then we will take those comments, have a revised document available for you in the January meeting. And at that January meeting, we'll ask for you to vote on whether or not to move forward with those policies. If you do so, we would then present it to the BCC for formal adoption, and we will use those as part of our budget development process in the spring. That's a model we want to follow for all of these financial policies. First, inform. Second, then ask for the vote. I don't like to rush people, and some of these issues are complex, and I want to make sure people have the opportunity to think about them before we ask your judgment to be expressed. So that's the process we're hoping to follow, and we're available to take any additional questions you may have. And I think, Lauren, you can stop sharing the screen at this point.
So I'm guessing that most of the, if people have questions, they should be forwarded to Lauren, correct, Greg?
All right, yes.
Okay. And then they will get passed on to Chris and Aaron for answers at the January meeting.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Were there any other kind of big questions following this presentation tonight?
Isn't there another presentation upcoming?
Yes, there is. There's a couple more.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm satisfied with where we are on this right now.
Okay. And again, I'm sure you will have more questions to William as well others, and we can forward those. And I'm sure they'll be presented at the January meeting, probably in the sense that in the same way that we're asking them. So, because it is a lot to digest, and it was not a lot of time for us to read through and you know. A lot of information. So I will then go ahead and move on. Thank you, Chris. And thank you, Aaron, for the presentation and discussion. And you're doing great work with that. I know it is very complicated, but we'll figure it out. And we're going to go on to Lynn is going to do a presentation on the Willamette Facilities Plan.
Yep. Hello, everybody. It's good to see you. And I can't tell you how much I wish we were in person. I think this is hour 7 for me on Zoom today, which is hard enough. But I really do just miss seeing you guys. So, but it is what it is. So let's get started. I am going to follow up on my presentations in January and September, concentrating on the Willamette Facilities Plan. As I said, we've been working on this for a couple of years so far, and we're nearly done. When we're done, we are going to ask for your support for the recommendations of the plan. And those will include, in the short term, a significant investment in wet weather capacity at the Tri-City facility. So tonight, I'm here to inform and discuss. Feel free to interrupt me at any time, but I'll pause every couple of slides and ask for questions. Next slide. So, to put in context for you, the Willamette Facilities Plan is just one piece of our capital improvement plan. And how we do this is we develop plans, and we've done quite a few over the last few years. And out of each plan comes a recommendation for new facilities to address either capacity or condition, and with a timeline, an implementation plan on when those should be done and how much they're going to cost, estimated. Then we lay those on top of each other and we come up with our comprehensive capital improvement plan. For example, out of the sanitary sewer master plan came a recommendation to expand the capacity of the Clackamas Interceptor up in the north part of the district. And we've moved forward with conceptual design of that. Also, expansion of the Willamette pump station and force main, and we've moved forward with that. And the new $9 million pipe on the 205 bridge is part of that recommendation. Out of that also came a very significant recommendation, and we've talked about it many times, and that is to reduce INI by 65% in 19 basins. So all of these plans, or many or most of them, are interrelated, and the sanitary sewer master plan is related to the Willamette Facilities Plan in that it tells us how much flow we're going to need to treat at Kellogg and Tri-Cities. Next slide. So a facilities planning process in wastewater treatment, or in anything but specific to wastewater treatment, looks at our facilities today. It looks at what we think we're going to need in 2040 based on capacity, condition, and regulatory issues. So capacity's pretty easy. It's based on population and buildable acres in the UGB. To some extent, condition of the collection system. Condition, we do an inspection, but it's also kind of like you own your house. You know you're going to have to replace your refrigerator every 10 or 15 years and your roof every 20 to 30. So we line those expenses out. Regulatory is not so certain. We know what we're going to need to, we know our current regulations, but we don't know what they're going to be in 2040. We have a pretty good idea. And what's important is that we consider everything we need to build in the short term, along with those anticipated regulations, and make sure we're not going to have any stranded investments. So are there any questions about planning so far and what we're doing and what the Willamette Facilities Plan is? No? Okay. Let's move on then. So we use a lot of acronyms, and we're trying to be better about that. But I thought what we would do is introduce you to a few of those that are very important. So I'm going to talk about BOD and TSS, and I'll explain what those are, and also our permit seasons. So those are the important things you need to know to understand what we're doing in the Willamette Facilities Plan. Next slide. So BOD is biochemical oxygen demand. We have to meet currently, big picture, two things in our permits. We have to remove BOD and we have to remove TSS. So BOD is the oxygen microorganisms consume as they degrade organic matter. Largely sewage is organic matter. And in a treatment plant, in the secondary treatment part of the treatment plant, we give microorganisms as much oxygen as they could possibly want to degrade the organic matter. So all of that is done before the water goes to the river, and we don't suck the oxygen out of the river and kill everything in it. Does that make sense to everybody, what BOD is? Okay. Next slide, total suspended solids. It's an easier concept. It's a measure of water clarity. The clear water on the left has low turbidity and low TSS. They're slightly different things. And high turbidity and TSS on the right. The way you measure TSS is if you poured a liter of water from the treatment plant through a filter of a certain size and collected all the solids like a coffee filter and then dried that out and weighed it, that's how much total suspended solids or TSS you had in that liter of water. And clearly, aesthetically, you don't want that in the river. Next slide. Any questions on TSS? William?
You mentioned a distinction between TSS and turbidity.
Turbidity is measured by light refraction, and TSS is measured as I described. Clearly, a turbid water has high TSS.
Is there any other distinction?
I'm no expert, but that's what I'm aware. That's what I understand. Greg?
I would just say that you can have water that's turbid, that's difficult to see through, that doesn't necessarily have high total suspended solids.
Dissolved iron, I suspect, would be make water orange, but it wouldn't have high suspended solids.
Yes.
Okay. For example. Does that have anything to do with this potability? I mean, could you have low turbidity that you wouldn't want to drink?
Could you have low turbidity that you wouldn't want? Yes. Well, that's
I suppose if you had something, I don't think like hydrochloric acid is clear.
Oh, good, 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 good. Okay. Thank you.
Good example. Yeah.
Okay. Next slide. So in wastewater treatment, we have two regulatory seasons. Dry season, May to October. Wet season, November to April. We have different regulations for those two seasons. In the dry season, we have to remove more BOD and TSS. And when we're talking about capacity in a treatment plant, the dry season capacity has to do with biology and removing BOD and TSS. The solid, and so that's secondary treatment usually and solids processing. So we just did the digester project and we needed that because we were out of capacity that was associated with load, which is BOD and TSS. Okay. And the same with the MBR. We were out of dry weather capacity. We built the MBR that gave us dry weather capacity. So it's called TSS and BOD are often called biological load or load. So that's what we're talking about there. In the wet season, we think about flow, MGD, million gallons a day. We have to treat, we don't have to treat as much. We don't have to remove as much BOD and suspended solids. But we have to pass all that water through the treatment plant. And that is a matter of hydraulics, really. And so there's certain parts of the treatment plant that deal with that. And that's influent pumping, screening, disinfection, because you have to pass all that water through. So two different seasons, two different things we worry about, two different ways of thinking about capacity.
Excuse me, Lynn?
Yeah.
I imagine that in the wet season, passing all the rest of that water through does take a little more wear and tear on our equipment. I mean, pumps have to pump harder.
Not necessarily. I mean, more pumps have to pump. We bring on more pumps in the wet weather.
Well, that to me is a load, not in your terminology, but it is a load on the system as to how much more has to be done, which it takes more energy and it takes, you know, lubrication and all the other stuff that goes anytime there's extra motion.
And absolutely.
That I think is harking back to my concept about, are all 6 months the same? And it seems pretty obvious to me they are not. I'll be thinking about that some more.
Okay.
Thank you.
There's thing we can talk about that. There's energy, there's chemicals.
Yeah.
There's power. You're right. So are there any other questions on wastewater basics, the permit seasons or BOD or TSS? Nope. Okay, let's move on. Okay, the Willamette Facilities Plan process. We're going to focus in on the facilities plan. Next slide. Right now, Kellogg Creek and Tri-City facilities have two separate permits, discharge permits. Kellogg, you can only discharge this much BOD and TSS. And just as an aside, there's a little bit of ammonia they have to remove, but perfectly able to do that with their other facilities. Tri-City permit, Tri-City, this is DEQ looking at these things, separate plant, not even related, could be on a different spot altogether relative to Kellogg. You have to remove so much BOD and TSS. Thank you, Greg.
Yes, did everyone see Greg Ierley's note in the chat box? Thank you.
Yep. Renee, did you have a question?
Yes. I was just starting to wonder, as far as the TSS and BOD load, is that like a percentage sort of thing, or is it total?
You mean our permit?
Yeah.
Concentration.
Okay. Which is why it's not an issue in the wet season.
So it's not as much of an issue. You're right. Concentration, there's a lot more water, but also biological activity is so much slower in the winter that it can be a little more, can be discharged to the river and it degrades so slowly. Mm-hmm. And the oxygen is more dissolved in cold water that it can keep up with it.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And also, if you have ever seen the Willamette in the wet after a rainstorm, it's pretty turbid. It's got its own TSS. Yeah. Okay, next slide. So, although the two plants are considered completely separate, they are not. And you guys have seen this before. We come down from the north part of the service area. 25 MGD goes to Kellogg Creek. The rest of it is peeled off to the south. It goes through our Intertie 2 pump station. We also have a Clackamas pump station, smaller, that takes flow from the industrial area, sends it to Tri-City. Not shown. And so those two plants, the point of the slide, are related. They aren't separate. And just, I'm not ignoring the stuff that comes up from the south to Tri-City, but just so you know, West Lynn, Oregon City, and Gladstone, to remind you, come by gravity to Tri-City and certainly plays into the capacity picture there. Next slide. So because we have a 190 now, it allows us to think about, if we combined those permits, would it be to our advantage? Where we could treat at Tri-City and have the permit say you can remove more at Tri-City, not have to remove, we would remove what we removed today at Kellogg, but in the future, if we have to remove ammonia or phosphorus, which is very likely, that takes real estate. That takes bigger tanks. It takes more tanks. We don't have room at Kellogg. Could we send that flow to Tri-City where we have the space to remove those constituents? And that's what the facilities plan is looking at. Next slide. So I talked about two permit seasons. Let's look at dry weather now. So we used a shorthand in our work. The blue, those little rectangles, means wet weather treatment. The yellow means conventional treatment, which is BOD and TSS removal only. The green means we would have to remove nutrients, which are ammonia and phosphorus. So today, our permit limits are scenario one, just secondary BOD and TSS removal of both plants. And today we have capacity to do that until 2040. So in, as part of our facilities plan, we don't have to do anything for dry weather. But we look to the future and we may have to remove nutrients. So anything we build today, as I said, we don't want a stranded investment. So we have to look at how would we do that in the future? Scenario 1.5 is, as I described, removing the nutrients at Tri-City, keeping Kellogg pretty much as it is. Scenario 3, if DEQ doesn't let us do that, would be removing nutrients or ammonia and phosphorus removal at both plants with individual permits.
Is that the green?
Yeah,
so, a little legend would be handy. It looks like the flag of Ukraine upside down to me.
Okay, noted. We'll do that. And there will be a legend in the facilities plan, but thank you. I will take care of that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Next slide. So any questions on dry weather? We're good till 2040 is the bottom line there.
Yeah. This is Renee again. I have another question about the nutrient removal. Are you anticipating that because of new regulations, or you're anticipating more of a load coming in?
New regulations, and I think Greg can answer this better than I can, Mr. DEQ.
Yes, and if we get to my presentation, which I kind of think we won't, I was going to go into some detail on that. But yeah, part of our requirements under the Clean Water Act are to meet effluent limitations that allow the water body that we discharge to meet water quality standards. The Willamette River was designated as having basically a problem with nutrients a few years back. And so that triggers a federal and a state process that will eventually lead to effluent limitations for nutrients for our facilities. We don't know when that's going to happen. It could be 5 years, it could be 10 years. We don't know, but it is something that we are anticipating happening. So basically the state has information saying there's a problem with nutrients, and that through the Clean Water Act process will lead to effluent limits for us.
What kind of nutrients are you talking about?
Well, typically it's nitrogen and phosphorus. But for us, to the best of my knowledge, it depends on what's causing, which one of those nutrients is causing the problem in the receiving water, which is the Willamette. And by all indications, it's phosphorus. Okay. So it would be, we would need to remove phosphorus from our effluent.
In my experience there, which is limited to Oregon, they're both put on, but maybe they'll just do phosphorus. I don't know. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, next slide. That took care of dry weather season. What weather season now, which is what where we're gonna need to spend some money and build some projects. Kellogg Creek we know is capacity limited to 25 million gallons a day. This is showing the rainfall, which is the blue dots, and the line, orange line, is influent flow from our, we had two big storms last year. This was the January storm, the bigger of the two. And we went over our capacity, which meant we went into our safety few inches towards the top of our tanks, and we don't design to pass that much flow. So, so Kellogg is capacity limited. Well, how do we handle that? We pump more to Tri-City. So next slide. This is the same storm at Tri-City where our capacity is 69, I call it 70 MGD. And we also blew past that last year.
MGD?
Yes, million gallons a day.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So it's time we're looking at this. And just Greg Ireland can correct me, but I think we were at 43 last week at Tri-City and 22 at Kellogg. Next slide.
You are correct.
So we are looking at how we would expand Tri-City's wet weather capacity. Well, we have a project through conceptual design and about to move into final design to upsize the Clackamas Interceptor, needs to be upsized. We're about to enter into a contract to upsize Intertide 2 pump station and force main. We're through conceptual design of the Willamette system, and we're putting that pipe on the 205 bridge. And we're, you've heard about the outfall, we're underway on that. So upstream and downstream of Tri-City, we're moving water. We're designing to move water. So to Tri-City and away from Tri-City, and we need to look at how we're going to expand Tri-City. So that's what we are doing in the facilities plan. Next slide.
Lynn?
Yeah.
In our long range planning, how do we account for the potential impacts of climate change, looking for a drier future?
Well, we're looking for, I don't know, it might be drier, but our storms are going to be more intense. And so the sanitary sewer master plan, we have a bit of a safety factor in there in terms of our upsizing our pipes where we could do that. We're required to pass a 5-year storm. We're at about 6 or 7 year, and where we were able to build in more capacity and not a huge additional expense, we went to a 10-year. So the numbers that we're looking at required at Tri-City take into account more intense storms.
So it's not the cumulative effect of less number of storms, it's the impact of those less frequent but greater.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We have to pass peak flows.
So if I can just chime in as a former regulator, the general approach up until now has been you need to be able to pass a storm event that happens once every 5 years. And looking back historically, and that's like, I don't know, anywhere between 2.5 and 3.5 inches in a 24-hour period, depending on where you are in this area. And after that, you kind of get a pass because everything's kind of overwhelmed and flooded. And so from a regulatory standpoint, you really don't have to design for bigger than that because it doesn't happen very often. But what we're finding and what the climate change science tells us is that those 1 in 5 year events are going to be happening more frequently. And so in our planning exercises, we look at not a 1 in 5 year event necessarily, but as Lynn said, a 1 in 6, 1 in 7, or even 1 in 10 year event and design to that.
So which may be,
No, it's kind of a belt and suspenders, even above the current regulatory threshold.
Yeah, hedging our bets a little bit that the what we call a 5 year storm today is, or 6 or 7 year storm today is a 5 year storm a few years down the road.
Thank you.
Yeah. Next slide. So, William, as you were alluding to, most of the time our flow's really, really low, like 8, 10 MTD at Tri-City. But, and our secondary capacity is 35. But a few times a year, we have peak flows. Right now, it's 3 times a year, approximately, that we have to do select treat or we don't have secondary capacity for the flow. In 2040, we're thinking that's about 9 times, you know, for a couple days. And the percentage of our flow is tiny. It's a huge capital investment to do that.
Yeah.
And it's an operational challenge to, you know, put on a whole bunch of tanks to cover a couple day storm. And that's
Labor costs as well? I mean, do we have to staff up for those events?
Well, IRLE can answer that. We don't staff up. We put more people on standby and such. We don't add people to our staff.
Thank you. Excuse me.
Uh-huh. But this is why we keep beating the drum on INI, because it reduces the peaks. INI control. So that's our challenge. And we looked at different ways to approach it. Next slide. This is what the Tri-City facility currently looks like. 70 MGD comes in and gets preliminary and primary treatment. We can treat 35 of it through secondary systems, and we have 2 different secondary systems, the MBR and conventional. If we get more than 35, we bypass secondary treatment, we settle it, disinfect it, and out to the river, and we meet permit this way in wet weather. Next slide. Other way, guys.
What's MBR?
Membrane bioreactor.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of secondary treatment. So this is what we're proposing. We're going to need to treat 105 million gallons a day. We'll take 60 through the old system and 45 through what we're going to call enhanced primary treatment. It is a system that's got a relatively small footprint because the water passes through it pretty fast. And we assist the or speed up the settling of solids by using a coagulant. And are able to meet our permit this way. And Salem does this. There's some places in Washington State that do it. The price tag on this is $53 million. It's not a stranded investment in that we can use that same process to remove phosphorus if we need to in the future. And that's our recommendation. It's possible that DEQ will not allow us to forego biological treatment for those high flows. And if that's the case, we will add some, this process or a process like this is called ActiFlow. We will add another basin, some other equipment, and provide just a little bit of biological treatment to satisfy DEQ. It provides very little additional water quality benefit, and that would add another $30 million to the project. We do not want to do that. I can tell you right now that's not our recommendation. But using this type of ActiFlow type system, ballasted sedimentation, it's called is our recommendation.
Greg D has a question, Lynn.
Yeah, I'm curious, do the PFAS play into any of the work you're doing on this right now, or is that future, the treating for the PFAS? Treating for PFAS? No.
Yeah, no, that's definitely on the future and will change the landscape across the country immeasurably.
So whatever we're doing, though, will allow us to, I guess, to do something without tearing something out. Is that kind of our...
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, anything like a PFAS is a source control issue, in my view. And we will look at, and I'm sure people will look at how conventional treatment plants that we have, how you could tweak that to improve PFAS removal. But it's controlling it upstream.
Got it. Thank you.
And so for those of you who we've talked about PFAS before, maybe a couple times, but I'm sure there's people that have come on since that don't know what it is. And I actually spent today in a national conference that, as well as a few other folks at WES, about PFAS, primarily, at least the first part. And so we're going to come back in the new year and remind people about what PFAS is and kind of what the regulatory environment looks like. It is definitely the, the potentially crashing wave from a regulatory standpoint for us.
All right, next slide. So the blue rectangles are what our recommendation for ActiFlow look like on the site at Tri-City. Relatively not huge, but that's the facility. And then next slide. And I said we have to fit whatever we're going to build into the future so that we don't have any stranded investments. And that takes quite a bit of engineering to figure that out. Of course, this is looking way, way down the road, 80 years, so things will change. But we have to assume something. And so this is our build-out site plan at Tri-City. And whatever we build today hydraulically will fit into that puzzle. Greg.
So you fit it in for the 80 years, and I know that's a long period of time, but as development occurs, so are you looking to buy more land around there? Just to, when I had a wastewater treatment plant, we bought all the land we could, and we kept buying land so that we didn't have development encroach up around us, so that, first off, people didn't like the wastewater treatment plant, but then secondly, we might need that land for the future.
Right, and the best odor control is buying property. It's the cheapest odor control. We own all that land. It's a landfill, so it's got to be remediated, but we own that. It's zoned industrial, for which wastewater treatment is an allowed use. There will be land use discussions with Oregon City. This is not the plan. It's different than the plan that was put forth 10 years ago.
What about the land below us being the bottom of the page?
So I'll chime in on that. That's land that's owned by, Chris is probably better to answer this, but it's essentially owned by Oregon City Economic Development Agency. And that's the what we've heard of as the Cove development. So that land directly on the bottom of that slide is going ultimately to be developed as a mixed use residential development and probably fairly high density. Plans have fallen through. There was grand plans in the works that fell through fairly recently, but we are going to have development around us. Chris, do you have anything to add as far as the land, what would be off to the right of that slide or up to the left?
Sure. So it's the Oregon City Urban Renewal Agency. Greg's exactly right, that owns that piece below. It's called the Cove Phase 2. So the apartments that are at the on the other side of Main Street there mm-hmm. are the Cove Phase One. So it is going. There is a somewhat vacant parcel adjacent to us towards the end of Main Street that is a warehouse that actually used to store fireworks and caught fire last year. Irony of ironies. Across the street from us, we are adjacent to a city park. I don't think that's going to change. And then there is a small community that has a development that has mobile home sales. There's a church and some houses across the street from us. And I can share that I have had conversations with owners of those properties within the recent months. And unless we seek to condemn property, I don't see any changes happening there anytime in the near future. But you're right, Greg, and we are looking at that for exactly the reasons you're talking about.
I guess there is a thin strip just across the street. That's Agnes going across the top there.
And yeah, that's actually ODOT land.
Well, not Agnes.
No, the other side of it.
That is true. We do own what is now Agnes Avenue.
And I'm just saying that maybe Agnes could be, chances are slim that it's ever going to be converted into a through street again. But that might be an opportunity to carve out just a little bit of extra real estate.
Yeah. We actually, the city, while it's still called Agnes, where the gate is, because I know you go walking in there, William.
Yeah,
that's pretty much the end of the public right of way. The city vacated the right of way for the street between that gate down to Main Street, and the majority of it just converted to being part of the west parcel. A portion of it became part of the ODOT right of way. So there's no strip of public road there anymore, although the city does have a water line that runs along that alignment.
And that's where our outflow is going to be going down too, as well.
Right. So for those of you looking at when you look at the center top B1, just above that is where that right of way ends, and we take ownership of that road off to the right. And there is a Oregon City water line and our outfall pipeline beneath that.
What about that little wedge between that B1 of B1 where the tip of a triangle up to Lewis and Clark Bank across the street there? I wish we were looking at this on Google Earth.
I don't want to get too far off topic here because we do have another discussion coming up. So maybe we can see a larger map at the next meeting or something and have more of a real estate talk or something. But I want Lynn to be able to wrap up her presentation here.
Thank you, Diane.
One last slide. And that is next up. So I'm anticipating a draft of the facilities plan in December. I will pass that on as soon as it's acceptable, pass on. And we will come back and seek your approval. Has to go to DEQ for approval and has to go to the board. So December, January is when you'll see more. And I'm willing to answer any questions you have between now and then, of course.
I think this is a good opportunity too for everyone to forward any questions to Greg and Lauren, to pass on to Lynn, because I'm sure we'll have another presentation on this in January with this needing to get wrapped up pretty fast, so. William, your hand is still up. Did you have another question?
Yeah. What should I apologize for being curious?
No. I didn't know if it didn't come down. So
it went down.
The screen changed and everybody moved. So,
on the last slide that we looked at about next motions, that was on page 57. but it slipped away from me because there's so much information being presented here tonight that I had a question about page 7, back when we were talking about the policies regarding contingency fees. And on page 7, it says fee increases will be approved prior to or at the time of the adoption of the budget. And here's the key phrase for me: a notification of any increase will be published on WES's website. Well, that's nice, but if you are just John Q. Public or Jane Q. Public, you may not be sitting on the doorstep of the website waiting for the next announcement. And I hope that there are going to be inserts into their utility bills. There will be other methods. I just thought it was odd that that particular method was called out when I think that it may be not as efficacious as some other methods.
You know, William, that's absolutely true. That's the procedural portion. I'm sure Aaron can chime in, or Chris, as to what we actually do to notify customers, which is much more robust.
Good. Thank you. That's all I had. Thank you.
All right. I think we're just going to go ahead and move on to the next topic, if that's okay, because we do have a rules and reg update from Ron.
Yeah, thank you. That was the hard stuff, Lynn and Aaron. So this will be easy, I'm sure. We've talked about this a bunch, and so we want to provide a rules and standards update tonight with the presentation of the key policies. That's the main piece. This is sort of not all that entertaining of a presentation, I apologize, but certainly one that is more working in nature. Can you go to the next slide, Lauren? So I hope tonight to kind of try and get through some background in about 5 minutes. I have my timer going. About the project itself and where we've been, and then spend the rest of the time really highlighting what are the most substantial policy changes in these categories, as you know, really the ones that are probably going to be the most significant for people to want to pay attention to. And then at the end, you know, my goal tonight is we're trying to advance this project to the next phase, which would be engaging the county commissioners in ordinance adoption, likely a couple of policy sessions to have similar conversations with them, and then hearings, and that's the formal public input process on ordinance adoption. So can you go to the next slide, Lauren? So we've talked about this a bit before, you know, why update the rules and standards now? One of the biggest pieces was the formation of WES a few years ago that brought all of our separate districts under one public partnership, for the most part, municipal partnership. So really kind of taking a look at what we had and trying to get everything in a new set of rules and standards that would serve the district going forward. And then also to make improvements, regional alignment, addressing new regulatory requirements as we see them coming, updating policies to reflect new technologies. It really gave us an opportunity to do something that really hadn't been done in over 20 years, which is do a significant update to rules and standards. Next slide, Lauren. So this is just a map of our geography that you guys are familiar with. And then on the right side were all of the separate documents that existed prior to the formation of WES as a municipal partnership. We had separate rules and regulations and separate standards for most of our districts. They all varied in their, you know, recent updates, and they varied in some degree in what they said. So we had a lot of moving parts, and it got fairly unwieldy to manage. The first step after we formed WES in around 2018 was to just bring all of those rules and regulations and our design standards under one document. So we basically just all stuck them all together and then started this project to rewrite them. This is an unusual rule update for rules and regulations in that it's a full repeal of what is there and a full replacement. I can't put in front of folks strike out and underline for the rules and regulations. Well, I could, but it would be everything struck. So it's challenging to do that. So we've kind of been, you know, kind of taking this piecemeal and presenting key policies as they come up. and as we prepared our final documents. But this is one of the major reasons we did the project. Next slide. Public outreach and engagement has been really a big deal and important to us as we've done this project. We started with listening. And as we knew that since this was such a significant update, we started with asking people what's working for you, what's not working for you, and what do you think we should work on. That started with stakeholder interviews and then a series of policy and technical workshops, both internal to WES and our partners like the county and Happy Valley and our frequent users of our rules and standards. And then also we formed an internal task force and met with them multiple times in late 2018, 2019 to get a little deeper into some of the issues. We did a whole series of community briefings in 2019 and 20 on the policies and the project itself. And then going through our public review process, we did an informal review earlier this year in April and into May, just to give people that first crack at seeing what the documents look like after we had talked about the policies and give us feedback to help shape the rules and standards, getting us to where we are today. Counselor, you have a question? I think you're on mute.
David, you're muted.
Sorry, forgot to unmute. I'm just wondering if before final adoption, you'll be presenting to cities what the final rules will be, or if it's something that's going to get passed prior to presenting to cities?
I think that's something that we've talked about and we certainly can do. I think, you know, right now we're looking for the recommendation from the advisory committee to proceed with final adoption and engage our board. And I think that would be a good opportunity for us to engage councils as well. Next slide, please. Thank you. So we received over.
Just on Councillor Gulaby's point, would you like us to, so typically we would take this to the advisory committee, get their approval and go to the board. I think what you're saying is that we should probably take this also to the city council at Happy Valley and get their thoughts, perspectives, and input before we go to the board of county commissioners. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that would be very much appreciated.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll do that.
Thank you very much. We'll do that.
Thank you.
So we received, and when we started looking at the major policies that we were going to try and address, you know, a lot of what we were putting together was just sort of rearranging what was already in our rules and standards for all the different districts. But a few things floated up to the top, and these were kind of the general categories that they landed in: some technical issues, fiscal issues, and some administrative issues. Next slide. And so we'll start to talk about some of those. Like I said, I think we have about a dozen of these. And what I would like to do is because this, you know, my goal tonight is to get to the point where the advisory committee is comfortable recommending that we move forward. I know that we might not get there. What I would like to accomplish tonight is to be able to present all of the policies to folks. I'd like to, not that they absolutely won't take questions as we go along, but if you could sort of take notes on what issues you have questions for, and then once I present them all, then we can go back and have discussion, if that's okay. Next slide, Lauren. So this is the first policy that I wanted to bring up. This one isn't really significant in terms of how we operate, but it's significant in that we're codifying a practice that we've had since 2013 on annexations into the districts along with cities. There was a policy session with the county commissioners a while back, and in that policy session was the direction to require that properties annex into a city and into WES prior to obtaining services. If a property was already in the district, we're obligated to serve them, but we were really this what we were hearing from the cities is that mainly Happy Valley and Milwaukee is where this is significant, that we wanted people to annex into a city prior to providing service. So we added a section to our rules, basically restating what was already our practice. So shouldn't really be a surprise to anyone, with the only caveat that if they're denied, if a city denies an annexation proposal from a property owner, that West would annex them to provide service if it was a dire need, like a failed septic system or something like that. That happens. That's happened a few times over the past few years. So that gives us clear authority to require annexation, and then also that can occur as needed. And you'll see this similar format on all of these issues as we go forward. I put some stars on the titles just for ones that you may not have seen before, because we did talk about the majority of these, but I don't think we brought this one up before because it wasn't really all that significant of a change, but it was one I wanted to highlight for the advisory committee. Next. So this one, again, I just thought this might be kind of interesting for the advisory committee. Right now, West doesn't have anything in our rules and standards about the use of our properties. Generally, the current policy is a no trespassing prohibition. We don't say you can or can't hike here, bring your dog, you can't have a fire, you can't camp here. And that can be a challenge, especially now as we're trying to manage our properties and the uses of them. So we added a section to the rules and really kind of modeled the rules of the North Clackamas Parks and Rec District's natural areas. But it gives us a lot more clarity on how to manage properties, and not everything we just need to say keep out. We can manage some properties like Three Creeks a little differently. So this was a good add, we thought. Next. Those were the main key, just sort of administrative policies that didn't fit into any of these other boxes. Next slide, Lauren. We'll talk about some of the financial policies. Low-income discounts we have talked about before. One of the issues that we're facing is that we have relatively low participation, we think, although we don't know what adequate participation is, but we have relatively low participation in our low-income discount program. Roughly, I think Aaron told me today, about 0.6% or something like that of our accounts currently are participating in the program. And so we just want to make sure that that's not due to some barrier, that people that might need the financial assistance get that financial assistance. One of the barriers that we identified was that we cap the level for households at two family members in the federal guidelines that we use. And that can be somewhat limiting, especially for larger households of 7-8 people or so. So our proposal is to stay with the 50% off the monthly sewer charge that we offer, but change the qualifying limits to 60% of the Oregon State median income, which is more commonly used for other programs like rent assistance and energy, and then have those be incrementally based on household size, which there's a table that we reference. And so the income limits are allowed to go up as household sizes increase. That should remove a barrier from folks that might, you know, be earning more in larger households to access the low-income discount. I think that's all I was gonna say about that one. Next slide. Reimbursement districts is also one we've talked to the committee before about. The issue being right now is that sometimes when developers build offsite sewers in order to connect to sewers, not the stuff that they build within subdivisions, but the offsite sewers, that they currently can't recoup some of the cost of constructing those from future connectors. This is a pretty common policy among all of our peers to have this. It's called different things among the different cities, but we don't have the ability to set these districts up. So it's a new policy where we would allow a developing party to request that we establish a reimbursement district, and then they can recoup costs in the future as West permits connections to that infrastructure. This should align us regionally and address an issue that was brought up when we did our stakeholder interviews. The one note that this is definitely could require, depending on how many requests we get, could be a hit on staff time and resources as we have to establish the districts and sort of deal with the agreements, collect payments, things like that. So it's possible that, you know, we're not proposing anything right now, but it's possible that there may be a fee associated. As you saw Aaron saying, that we have some cost recovery goals. So that's the significance I wanted to flag there. Next slide.
Ron, real quick, is that something water districts do, is create those reimbursement districts?
I don't know. Maybe someone else on the call knows. We just compared to the wastewater and stormwater providers around Clackamas County.
Okay.
We've talked about our equivalent dwelling unit methodology, both for non-residential and residential projects. Starting with non-residential, we had a whole meeting presentation dedicated to this, that we recognized that some of our non-residential assignments were not as representative of sewer impact as they could be. They were a little high, particularly for large buildings like warehouses and storage units, big building footprint, sometimes big land and not much of an impact. And so we redid the table that's in the rules. It's now updated table A1 that encompasses all of the EDU assignments. And we increased the square footage formula for warehouses and storage facilities. And we had presented some case studies that showed it's much more aligned to water consumption now than it really was before, which we used as a comparison. So that's good for those. We made some minor tweaks to restaurants in terms of seating capacity and health clubs, which is something we didn't have before that has kind of an odd water usage. But for the most part, things are better aligned than they were before. It's a minor loss in SDC revenue. I don't remember. I can get that number from Aaron's team that had projected what we might see just for warehouses and storage units, which are infrequent. But because most of West's SDC revenue is residential in nature, it's not that big of a hit on SDCs. Next slide. So for the residential stuff, and I think we had a meeting on this one as well, and the advisory committee had said, yes, let's go ahead and pursue this approach, is right now that our residential EDU assignments aren't necessarily aligned with water usage in residences either. And so potentially not their impact to the sanitary system. Right now, a detached residential unit is a one, no matter what the size. And then attached units like multifamily and ADUs are 80% of a unit. What we proposed after doing a bunch of research that we presented before about the relationship between water consumption and household size, and then using national occupancy data to relate to the number of occupants a house and of homes and their size, we were able to establish a relatively good alignment between roughly categories of house sizes and EDU assignments that would be more fitting. And I have a slide right after this that I can that I'll switch to so we can see that. But right now, so ranging from 70% to 120% of a standard residential unit, we would assign EDUs and thereby SDCs. We did do some research on apartments, and they're kind of all over the board. It really depends on the size of an apartment development. Smaller ones generally have bigger impact. Larger numbers of units have smaller impacts. And then that sort of central tendency really aligned at the what we use now, which is 80% for multifamily apartments. So we're proposing to stick with that. The committee asked us last time to take a harder look at accessory dwelling units, which we did. In accessory dwelling units, you know, they still have the fixtures and that normal homes really have. And when it came to occupancy data, they don't really get that much. You know, one is as low as you can go. We felt comfortable taking that down to about 60% of a standard residential unit, but the data doesn't really support it any lower than that. And so the significance, one, this does align with the methodology that the county is using for assignment of traffic impact fees or transportation impact fees. The county commissioners have already adopted a methodology that's very similar to this. It's just different numbers because trips and wastewater are not the same thing. And then also an analysis Erin and her team had done that said there's relatively minor impact on SDC revenue going forward for funding our CIPs.
Hey Ron, I just want to say I'm really proud of this work that Ron and Erin did. Obviously we're not in the business of subsidizing or the housing, affordable housing. But our charge is to assess the impact of development and what those dwelling units cost for our wastewater treatment. And I think the way that Ron and Erin approached this in a very analytical way and it was, I think, kind of groundbreaking, frankly. I'm just really comfortable that with this tiered system and the way that we essentially kind of threaded the needle a little bit. And arrived at a really, equitable solution. So thank you.
Can you go to the next slide, Lauren? This is roughly what that looks like. Again, the assignments that we talked about before from 70% of an EDU to 120% on the home sizes. So, the majority of the houses that we permit or that connect to our systems are in that middle bracket. You get out on the tiers, and it should provide a better alignment with the residents' actual impact on the system. Thank Erin for that graphic. Erin and Chris just presented this at a conference, and that was from that. Next slide. System development charge financing. I think this is called installment payments in our current rules. The current issue that we have is that our current financing policies really have no limits on the types or amounts of SDCs that can be financed. And so this can cause some cash flow issues, particularly for larger projects. We have requests for people to, fund upwards of to ask for financing of SDCs up to $1 million. And that can create some problems. There's also a significant commitment, especially when we get at these larger dollar amounts of West staff resources for doing financing agreements, due diligence, credit checks, collecting payments, and people don't pay us, and that happens as well. So what we're proposing, the other issue too, I would just add from the current policies that allows it, and I think this might be tied to statute, because we do have to have a program like this to provide some financing options, but it's over a 10-year period. So what we're proposing in the rules after talking to Chris and Erin about what they'd like to see in terms of this policy is limiting the installment payments or SDC financing to residential and multifamily residential developments that have 10 or fewer EDUs. That aligns better with the original intent of these policies, which is to support small residential connections, particularly if there's hardship or need, and it greatly reduces financial risk to the district. Next slide. So getting into a couple technical issues on sanitary sewer, we didn't really hear a lot from folks about issues that they're experiencing with sanitary sewer. We're fairly well aligned with our peers. But there were a couple. Lauren, can you go to the next slide? One of them was sanitary sewer slopes. This was in our public review draft earlier this year in April or May, but I don't think we talked about this with the advisory committee before. One of the issues that we see from our permitting folks see is that we currently have a policy of a minimum slope of 1% for main lines, 2% for dead end lines. And we do allow for shallower slopes of different sizes of pipes that flow half full or full. If the design engineer can demonstrate that we'll meet certain velocity guidelines of like 2 feet per second for certain sizes of pipes flowing full or half full, then you can approve shallower slopes. That's pretty consistent with some of our peers, Oregon City, Westland. We did some benchmarking One of the challenges is we have very few people make that case and show that there's that their design would have that velocity at a pipe flowing full or half full. And so our staff wanted to try and change the policy where we would meet the same intent, but make it a little better aligned with, one, make it clearer and easier to use, and two, would make sure that we're protecting our operations and long-term maintenance by getting the pipe slopes that we need for scour. So the proposed policy change is to stick with the 1% and 2% for main lines and dead end lines that we have, but to change the criteria for shallower slopes based on a number of homes served, so that you could go less than 1% on a slope. You go to 0.75% slope for pipes that are serving 20 to 40 homes, and down to 0.5% for pipes serving greater than 40 homes at full build out. This sets the minimum. The significance is it sets the pipe slope at 0.5%, which is slightly higher than we would currently allow at 0.045% with a pipe flowing full or half full. But as I said, to make sure we get the adequate pipe slopes that we need to reduce our maintenance costs and risks of SSOs where we just have material building up in pipes. Next slide. Sanitary service connection ownership. This is one that I don't think we've talked to the advisory committee about either, but was in our public review draft in April of this year. A conversation internally between our operations and engineering folks recognized that there is the district's current policy to the district's current policy. The current policy is that building owners and property owners are responsible for their service connections from buildings to either a right-of-way line or an easement line, and that WES is responsible for that service connection from that line to the main line, including the connection. Especially now, as you know, we see every home transaction requires a sewer scope, and we're seeing a lot of service connections being replaced. That creates a significant amount of responsibility and liability for WES that our operations and engineering folks thought that we shouldn't bear. We did some benchmarking, and it's kind of half and half across the board what our peers are doing when it comes to service connection ownership. But the proposed policy would be to change it so that property owners and building owners are responsible for those service connections all the way to the main line, not just to the right-of-way line. And that would include the connection to the main line. This assigns the significance, and it is important. It assigns the responsibility and cost to property and building owners and reduces risk to the district. That was the purpose of that policy change. Next slide.
Hey Ron, can I just say, so just to remind folks, so when development happens, the developer, whether it's a single family or multi, a subdivision, they're responsible for the connection and the construction up until our main line. It's really not, it's not like we install or, do anything between that, either easement or, property line to our main line. That's all done at the time of installation. So just want to make that clear.
So there's a few technical policies on stormwater management we'd like to touch on. As I know we're getting shorter on time. Next slide, Lauren. So three of them are about, the next three slides are all about performance of stormwater facilities. And they're all kind of, the underlying issues are the same to some degree, in that we have emerging and now final regulations coming from the state of Oregon with reissued municipal stormwater permits that require things like low impact development and green infrastructure, which we have to accommodate, and also set some more specific performance standards for how stormwater facilities function to manage runoff from sites. And that's usually, flow control and water quality to some degree. And so we'll step through those. For flow control right now, which is just controlling the peaks and volumes and durations of flows, right now we use a peak matching approach, meaning you match or reduce peaks from pre-development or from post post-development back to pre-development. That right now it's you have to reduce the 2-year 24-hour peak runoff rate to half the 2-year pre-developed rate. One of the issues with that is that the science has evolved over the years that when you reduce those peaks, you actually extend the durations of those erosive flows, and even reducing them down to half the 2-year can be erosive to urban streams. And so some jurisdictions and some other states, but more locally like Oregon City and Wilsonville, have already adopted a new flow control approach of matching peak flow rates, but also matching durations of flows to make sure that streams are so that we're protecting streams and so that they are stable. This is not too much of a change for folks, because as we'll talk about in the next slide when we get to it on infiltration, you know, our infiltration standards and flow control standards work in tandem, but in large parts of our district, infiltration is just not feasible. And so we end up getting a lot of variance requests to waive infiltration requirements, and we end up going to this anyway. So a lot of the ponds, the detention ponds that have been built in the district over the past several years are already meeting this standard. So we didn't hear a lot from our task force and from the engineering community on moving to this. I think they're used to seeing it in Oregon City and Wilsonville, so at least on this side of the river, and they're kind of used to doing it within our district. One of the significances, of course, of that impact is we might see larger facilities on some sites, particularly sites. If you have a site that has really good infiltration and you don't infiltrate and you try to detain it all in a pond, your pond's going to be really big. We're kind of trying to incentivize infiltration and hope that people will use that approach if they can, but certainly there could be a loss of developable land as ponds get bigger, and that would be more costly. Next slide. On-site infiltration, and we have talked about these before with the advisory committee in previous presentations. As I just said, on-site infiltration, we tend to get a lot of variance requests for this because it's hard to get water into the ground. And so in moving to a flow control strategy that actually controls durations of erosive flows and doesn't just squash the peaks down, we can change this to from required to preferred where feasible, and we still get adequate protection from the flow control standard that we're proposing, as we just discussed previously. Next slide. The last piece is water quality treatment. Our new municipal stormwater permit, actually our current one does, but it's reinforced and clarified in the new one that the state expects low impact development and green infrastructure to be the preferred approach to stormwater management during development. So we have to prioritize that, and they were specific about a water quality treatment performance standard of 80% total suspended solids removal, which Lynn already explained what that is, so I don't have to. Our current policy is a goal of 80% total suspended solids removal, but it's not a requirement. And one of the issues with that is it allows the use of some treatment technologies that aren't protective of water quality and don't provide basic treatment, mainly hydrodynamic separators. And we see a lot of those within our service district. So we're proposing the same volume of water quality in our performance standard that needs to be treated, and saying that we prefer to see vegetated facilities, but we will certainly allow mechanical and proprietary devices if they can meet that standard. That's the most significant change to our water quality performance, and that's been generally supported by the people we've talked to. Next. So we're going to talk briefly about stormwater facility maintenance access and some limitations we're proposing to put on the use of retaining walls. I just wanted to start with this picture. This is a development in Happy Valley that has significant amounts of retaining walls around the facilities. The two retaining walls in the back part of the picture are over 12 feet high, certainly well in exceedance of 10 feet high. We have minimal space along the top to try and manage vegetation and almost no ability to get into this facility to remove any vegetation or sediment. It's almost entirely walled, and the wall that I took this picture on that I'm standing on is over 6 feet high. But I just kind of want to get this in people's minds. These are highly problematic for us. Next. So while we're finding some difficult access, we did some benchmarking and found some jurisdictions that just limit the amount of retaining walls that can be used to build stormwater facilities. So in our, we don't have a limit right now in our access, in our access standards for stormwater facilities. And these are just for public facilities, by the way. We would say that we would limit walls of 10 feet high for 50% of the circumference of the facility and 6 feet for the remaining. That allows us to have better access. So we did hear some concern from Roseanne and some engineers that we work with quite a bit about some of the ponds that they built in Happy Valley. They sent us a few examples and our permits team reviewed those examples, and actually the examples they sent would be approvable under this standard. So it wasn't the one we just looked at. That's a different one, but you know, we don't think this will be too restricting, but certainly it is a new restriction and that could require more land and some additional cost as well, although retaining walls are expensive. Next slide.
Hey Ron, sorry, can I, so when we're talking about those requirements, that's for us to maintain those facilities?
Yeah.
So typically, you know, we have an option. If a subdivision builds a facility, they can maintain it themselves, or they can have us maintain it. And so this is basically us saying, well, if you want us to maintain it, you need to meet these standards.
Okay.
Yeah, to some degree, and too, on the private side, we are now asking for people to submit a maintenance plan, an access and maintenance plan, so we can review it. Because you can kind of say, well, if it's private, you know, that's going to be your own issue. But in my experience doing this for a long time, you know, particularly with residential subdivisions, that can be a problem later. So you kind of have to look out for future homeowners, for sure. But we do have different standards right now. Next slide, Lauren. So I know we're well out of time, and this may not be realistic, but we're, you know, looking for, if everybody thinks everything looks fantastic and we're comfortable with where we are with the project, then we are at some point looking for the committee to concur with these key policies and recommend that we engage the board in ordinance adoption. And so now we have some questions, I'm sure. Diane, do you want me to pick people? Or
yeah,
do
you go ahead, Ron. Yeah, you got okay. A couple hands up.
Greg DiLoretto.
Okay. No, well, just and to say, if not, we're perfectly fine putting this off until our January. So
thanks, Ron. This was great. And the way you laid it out was perfect. And of course, the ones you've laid out are the ones we have questions on. This is a big document. So the fact is, you probably should read it all. And I would suggest, I think we need to perhaps slow this down to do that, because at least the ones that I have, like four questions, and they're not questions, they're really policy discussions about how we think things ought to happen. And I'll just tell you, you know, one of them was the annexation one, one of them was the camping one, the other one is the fact that the policy proposes that the homeowner now owns the sewer lateral all the way out to the main. And that's, having come from a background where that wasn't the case, that's to me a huge issue. And so those are going to, in my mind, require some discussion that we really don't have time for tonight. And so I just, Madam Chair, I throw that out, that I think this is really important. And I don't think we can underestimate how important this is to Wes in terms of their ability to operate this organization. And it's just key that they be able to do this. But so we need to talk about a few of these key policy issues, because we have to recommend this to the, I guess, the county commissioners or so.
And it has to fly by the cities as well. So yeah, we have to make sure we have all these ducks in a row before we present it to the cities or the BCC. And I agree, we should move this on to the January meeting, Greg, and get these discussions going and our questions answered beforehand. So, William.
Yeah, I want to echo the comments about Ron. This is an outstanding job. This is a Herculean task. And I want you to know that we really appreciate all the work that you have been putting into this. I mean, I'm sure it's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. And I also concur that we need a little more time. Thank you, Greg, for bringing that up. We need a little more time to chew on some of these that really are policy decisions. I had two, one having to do with the annexations also, and also with the reimbursement districts. I had some questions about that, but rather than take up time tonight, as long as it's going to be on a future agenda, we don't need to act on this tonight other than to recommend that we hold this over till our next meeting.
I agree. And Ron, this has been not just tonight's presentation, but each of your presentations at our meetings have been very thorough. I think very easy to understand for most of us. And I really appreciate it. And it was really hard because you literally did throw out everything and then start new and try to cobble together all these different policies that were in place. So we're almost there. We're almost to the finish line. So right. Give us one more meeting and hold your questions for the next meeting. I think that, and then Lauren says she send in your questions in advance of the January meeting to help make it more efficient. I think that's a great idea too. And there might be others as well. So you both bring up great points.
And not only that, but reach out to me. We discussed a few things with Roseanne and input from the home builders, and we got a bunch of public comments in April, and we met with most of the people that commented to discuss it. So I'm happy to carve out as much time as you need. If you just want to flag issues or ask before we meet again, that would be great for us to make sure we get you what you need. And we knew this was a big ask. And so, it's totally worthy of another conversation. And just even Greg and William flagging, I have questions about those things helps me too. So let's talk about those.
Great idea. Great. And I have to go backwards a little bit because Lynn, I didn't thank you for your presentation. We moved on so quickly because we were running out of time. I didn't thank her. We were just like, hurry up. We got to get onto Ron. So all these presentations are so fascinating. And I don't know why, but that's just me. But we're going over some really important things. So we want to make sure it's all right. And there's Greg D, if you or William want to get together with Ron too, I know he's open to that as well, so that some of these questions can get answered face to face. So, and Greg Geist.
Actually, I think Roseanne was first.
Roseanne.
Thanks. So a couple things. I would really just implore the team, and I know you guys, everyone's under tight timelines, but if we could have a more advanced notice with the packet materials, especially such a hefty one like this. So we don't have to get into all the whys. I know there's always reasons, but we have to have more than 2 days because it came out like at 4:00 on Tuesday. And then secondly, I just want to give kudos. We fully support the EDU methodology. I have no issues with it. It's fully baked in my mind. And in fact, I've bragged on both Clackamas County and West to DLCD for the tiered and variable rate methodology that you guys have put forward and that Transportation at Clackcow has put forward and already passed. And they reached out to me and asked for like all the documentation, and I sent it to them. I don't know if they reached out to you, but you guys are really are on the forefront, like Greg said. And so I just want to give you complete kudos for that, because it is a very big equitable move. And then finally, yeah, we definitely need more time on the rules and regs. Just having been engaged over the past year, need a little bit more time to look at them. Thank you.
Greg?
Thank you, Roseanne, for that. I just wanted to, so two quick things. I didn't get to my presentation, but you should have gotten an invite for the WEF or the West Award holiday celebration for December 15th today. And we invited you folks and the BCC, and it's really to celebrate the WEF Award and the holidays. And so we're going to do that. It's from 1:00 till 2:30. BCC will talk at 1 o'clock and hope one or more can join. And then I guess, as far as my presentation tonight, I was going to give an overview and kind of Clean Water Act, why we do what we do. So I'll tease that for next time, because I think I need about 20 minutes. And so I'll start with the start and give you a quiz. And what is, whose guess is, like, when water pollution laws started in the United States? What year? Any guess?
Like ones that when we were a country, or do you mean like when there were Native Indian tribes and their rules?
We were definitely a country.
Okay.
Good. That frames it a little bit. Yeah.
Oh gosh.
Wasn't that under Reagan? Like Ronald Reagan?
No. No.
Was it
1940s? Oh, yes. No.
1983.
Absolutely not.
1901, 1902, 1903.
Wrong direction, William.
Ooh, 1800s, guys.
Oh my gosh.
No way.
Really?
My method worked.
Wait, what was it? 18 something?
Are you talking about when the Clean Water Act was passed?
No. I'm talking about when the first regulations about water... We'll call it quality.
1840.
Water, too early. So actually it was 1899.
Oh, that was my next guess.
Well, I said you just needed to go backward, William. 1901.
Really?
The Water Pollution, the Rivers and Harbors Act.
Wow. And
basically it prevented people from dumping garbage and anything that would impede navigation.
What about tea boxes?
Perhaps.
They weren't necessarily concerned about the quality of water. They were worried about things getting in the way of the boat.
Exactly. Yeah. It's all about commerce. Yes. Yeah. It's definitely about commerce. So anyway, teaser, that was the beginning of my presentation that I'll give next time.
Okay. All right. And we're over our time. So thank you all for hanging around. Thank everyone for your presentations tonight. And we will make sure we get January's packet out to you well in advance of the meeting. And we don't mean to dismiss this tonight, but if you do have other topics of conversation or ideas that you want to bring forward that you want to have us talk about, give those to Lauren as well. But definitely, we have plenty of big things to talk about, but we want to make sure everybody contributes their own questions as well. So with that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everyone. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving. Have a great time with your family and friends.
Thank you. Have fun.